The student works of great composers often revealed the greatness that was to come later in their lives. This is Student Composer of the Month, where we talk about anything and everything with composers who study or have recently studied in the greater Baltimore area, here on WBJC.com. This month's Student Composer of the Month is the first in our series that I have performed works by. We have Steve Crino in the studios today. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
I am all right, thanks. So, you are currently a student at Peabody, is that correct?
Yes, so I'm finishing up my master's there. I'm going to be continuing on for the doctoral program next fall.
Okay, great. So, and who do you study with right now?
So currently I work with Kevin Putz, but I actually split my time between Professor Putz's studio and Michael Hirsch's studio.
All right. And will you be studying with anybody new in the fall?
So I will be returning to Professor Hirsch's studio.
All right. Yeah. So you were did you start out with Professor Putz in the beginning of your master's program and then start to work with Professor Hirsch?
So actually the opposite. I started with Hirsch.
Uh-huh.
And just by chance, Professor Hirsch had a particularly large studio that year.
Uh-huh.
And just offered it to all of his students to say, hey, if you want to work with another teacher, here's who has spots available.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought about it and, I felt like it would be a good idea to just get a second perspective while I was at Peabody. We are so fortunate to have such a fantastic faculty.
Oh, yes.
And I saw that Professor Putz had a opening in his studio, and it just seemed like a good decision based on the type of music I was writing at the time. So I went.
Mm-hmm. I know that Professors Putz and Hirsch are both, they have, I would say, I mean, to me, they both have well-known vocal works.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Professor Putz has his Pulitzer from Silent Night.
Right.
And then I actually performed a choral work of Professor Hirsch's, and it was a choral work of yours that I got to perform.
Yes.
Do you think that either of them particularly has an influence on your vocal works?
So I would say that... I think one of the things that attracted me to both of them as composers is their ability to write for the voice.
Uh-huh.
And I think they handle writing for the voice in such different ways.
Uh-huh.
If I had to kind of compare myself to either one of them, I would say I definitely am closer to Professor Putz's aesthetic in general.
Uh-huh.
And I think the way that he handles vocal writing. But I have to say my love for writing vocal music really was with me before I started at Peabody, and it was one of the reasons that I was drawn to Peabody in the first place. My first composition teacher, who I worked with in Philadelphia, where I'm from, it was a composer, Dr. Benjamin C.S. Boyle, who is an extremely talented composer and a fantastic teacher. And his work, although he writes for all... mediums, really. I would say he's best known for his art song composition and his choral composition. And so working with him, I think it was kind of natural for me to pick up on his love of vocal music. And that was really my first introduction into composition. And so...
So he was your first teacher?
He was my first teacher, yeah. I started working with him in, I think it was my... junior or senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
His pedagogical approach and just his philosophy about composition has really stuck with me through the years. His training method is very influenced through the pedagogical approaches of Nadia Boulanger, the famous French educator.
Of course.
And so with in my lessons with Dr. Boyle, so much of what we did was very craft-oriented, and I think that's really the best word to kind of associate with the Boulanger training, as it is a very craft-based training, and it really helps composers utilize the essential elements of composition and through their own voice.
That's what I was going to ask about, because I know that Boulanger would tell her students to compose in their own voice.
Yes.
That's how she trained George Gershwin. That's mm-hmm. how... she trained, I think, didn't Aaron Copland work with Boulanger?
Yes, so Copland is one of her famous students. She taught Elliot Carter briefly, Walter Piston. The list goes on and on.
Of course. Yeah, those are just the two names that I thought of first, you know, American composers especially.
Mm.
And before you worked with your first composition teacher, when did you get an interest in composing?
So that's a really good question, because I definitely just fell into composition. My upbringing with music was very much in a like rock and mostly a rock and roll tradition, I would say. Although there is music in my family, my grandfather was a professional trumpet player and played in like classical music and Broadway and all over the place. I really grew up with like 60s, 70s classic rock in the house, and eventually started playing drum set. Was really my first major instrument.
That's what I play too.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that was really...
Rock-wise.
Like, yeah, nice. And although I did take some brief piano lessons before playing drums, I moved away from those piano lessons because at the time it made... I wanted to just kind of play based on what I was hearing.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't like the classical training of just playing what was written in front of me without really understanding what's creating any of this music.
Right.
So I think, you know, I guess looking back in retrospect, there was always that interest in understanding what how music is really composed, or what are the pieces that go together.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt, you know, I was a young kid, and so I really, you know, wasn't I wasn't thinking this through necessarily. I was just kind of following my instincts. And
did any of us as kids?
No, exactly. And so, you know, I felt that although I, you know, I continued teaching myself piano and learning music theory on my own, my instrument was drum set, because I felt that I could just kind of freely create in a rock setting, and I could just kind of let my ears go. So I stuck with that all through high school. And as I said, I was playing the piano, but I wasn't really studying the piano. It was more a vehicle to understand music theory and to just continue this piano improvisation that I was interested in as a child. And through that, I think some of my first pieces came about. I had one or two small like jazz arrangements I did, because I got into jazz drums a little bit, and I was playing in a rock band, and so I was, you know, assisting in the creative process all through my childhood with that. But I wasn't really taking center stage as the composer. It was more, I think, because of my position behind the drum set, I kind of let the other members of the band really bring the initial material kind of to the rehearsal, and it would become my responsibility to kind of sculpt it and be like, okay, we need a contrasting section here, or the bass needs to really like get brought out in this situation or something. So
they would bring in the sketches and you would sort of assemble them into a piece.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And of course, you know, it was a very collaborative process, but I think that if I had to say what my role in that collaborative process was, it was really bringing the different things together. And I think I was mostly in control of that process.
Right.
It's
a way of writing rock music that I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, no, it was really it was fun, and we worked together, and it was my closest childhood friend, so we all got along, and it was just a blast making music with them.
And you said you're from Philadelphia?
Yes.
So in the city or just outside of it?
Just outside of the city. Mm-hmm. So technically South Jersey. About 15 minutes from Philly.
Uh-huh.
I did my undergraduate in Philadelphia at Temple University.
All right, cool. Yeah, I'm from Pittsburgh.
Oh, great.
Originally. So you studied at Temple for your undergrad.
Yes.
And who did you work with there?
So at Temple, I worked with two composers primarily, Jan Kruzwicki and Alexander DeVarin.
Mm-hmm.
They were both really great teachers. I think they brought their own, their own ideas about composition into the mix. And I think the best way to kind of summarize the education that I received in my college / early high school years is really bringing together what I learned privately with Dr. Boyle and what I was exposed to at Temple.
Uh-huh.
Because the training that I explained with Dr. Boyle through this Boulanger lens, very craft-oriented, the repertoire, and also the repertoire we were looking at, was definitely certainly more pretty exclusively tonal music, I would say, with a few exceptions, mostly 19th century and prior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did look at Britten and Barber and Copland,
right,
and Stravinsky and things too, but...
But when it came to the 20th century, it was more standard stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was composers that you could see those values very clearly in their music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really the guiding principle for what repertoire was being discussed in lessons. At Temple, I kind of had somewhat of an opposite experience where I would bring what I was talking about in my lessons privately into my lessons at college and be like, oh, why don't we talk about doubling and spacing of chords, or like how, you know, how, look, let's talk about the counterpoint in this passage or something. And that was not really, they weren't nearly as craft-based, or at least not in the lessons.
It sounds like in college they were more working about, they were more working with what kind of, it was more of a theoretical approach to your composition rather than more looking for your voice to be heard more. Not that I would suggest that they were trying to suppress your voice.
I'm sure
you wouldn't say that about them either. Mm-hmm. More like they were more interested in exploring the theoretical aspects of what you were bringing to them.
Yeah, I think they were also really interested in just in expanding. I think that because, you know, when you're an undergraduate composer, so much of the challenge of or the education is just exposing you to what's out there, because maybe you just don't quite know what you like. Mm-hmm. And so I think that their teaching philosophy was definitely more in that vein of saying, well, let's talk about other compositional processes. Let's talk about serialism. Let's talk about spectralism. Let's talk about all these things. And that was, and although I definitely, you know, I was definitely more or less enthused about different ideas that they were talking about, I'm very thankful that I was exposed to all those things, because I do think that creates a much more well-rounded education. And so I really felt that my private studies and my collegiate studies were very much complementing one another in the end.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking this was going, that it wound up being that you started out with the whole creating your own voice sort of aspect of learning how to compose, and then your college professors would talk about how you could take, perhaps figure out, you know, what actually your voice wants to be based on perhaps learning about what other stuff is there.
Yeah, no, I think it was just broadening the scope, you know. Mm-hmm. Just helping a student see that there's so much music to be listened to and
right.
To be filtered through your voice.
Right.
Besides just the technical training that one can have.
Yeah.
But I think both are very are still with me today. I mean, I really I very much feel that the pedagogical approaches that Dr. Boyle used in his lessons and other teachers that are that ascribe to this, I think they're extremely important tools for teaching composers how to utilize these elements in composition.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it's important to also be aware of what is going on and seeing how other composers have thought of other, you know, ways to handle these different parameters. So,
absolutely.
You know, I think that's really, so I'm very fortunate. I felt like my education was ideal in that sense.
Yeah. So from one side of the coin to the other, and so now after your master's degree and moving on to your DMA, working with Professors Putz and Hirsch, what direction would you say that trajectory continued in as you progressed towards Peabody?
Sure. So I think that the trajectory is ongoing still. I mean, I would say, although I have goals that I have as a composer, and I'm I'm always trying to push them. But I would say I'm certainly, you know, it's an ongoing process.
It's never finished.
Sure. But I think there's a part of me that always enjoys simplicity in music. And I think with some of the pieces that we'll examine, you know, you'll definitely hear that some things are extremely, extremely diatonic, very straightforward. And I think that that's something that I don't wish to replace necessarily. I think my goal when I got to the end of my undergraduate, this was kind of something, this line of thinking that we're kind of going through right now, it naturally just came up when I had these two different, you know, pedagogical philosophies or just, you know, just educational, processes taking place. And I thought about, why not synthesis? Like, how can we bring these things together? And so I think different pieces of mine reflect this desire for synthesis in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I try and use sometimes is just different techniques from the 20th century. So using like more set theory or 12 tone, you know, but I use it in my own way. You know, but I think as I was talking about before, like the desire to replace simplistic language or something with something more complicated, that was never my intention.
Right.
I think it's more expanding the palette of what you have, so that you can have these different emotional extremes within your compositional voice. And I think that they in fact also complement each other, because you can really juxtapose the two sounds. So that's something that, yeah, I've explored in some of my pieces. And, you know, I would say that on a whole, it's definitely something that has been more based around harmony in my music. Like, harmony is something I'm extremely interested in my music. And it's just something I've always naturally gravitated towards. And so I think having these different having these harmonic extremes and having this wide palette to work with is something that I'm always trying to build. And I think other elements of my music, such as having a stronger maybe timbral presence in my music, or where timbre is more not just a product of orchestration, but more an integral part of the compositional, like of the content of the piece. That's something I'd like to maybe try and do more in my doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it, I would say that I'm still, if I had to, so I would say I'm still more on the conservative side with things,
uh-huh.
But it doesn't bother me. I'm still pushing forward, and it really depends on the piece.
And, you know, what one might call conservative, another just might call more, even more, not to use the term in a bad way, but more approachable.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say one of the pieces that we have to hear today would be a good example of what you were saying?
So I think let's take a look at Alchemist in the City first.
All right.
So it's a bigger piece. But I think that you can hear some more harmonic contrast in that piece than in some of the others. The other art songs are much more in a simplistic vein.
I would want to hear that too, actually.
Yeah, no, we can definitely do both.
But yeah, let's do The Alchemist in the City first.
Okay.
And who are the performers on this?
Sure. So there's quite a few of them. So Alchemist in the City is for a mixed octet and baritone.
Mm-hmm.
So the baritone is Christopher Hartung, and it was conducted by Alan Buxbaum. But the performers are Geary Kim on the flute, Eric Black clarinet, Taylor Davis percussion, Aaron Baker harp, and then we have a string quartet made up of Nicholas Bentz, Maitre Muralidharan, Jonathan Millard, and Jerem John.
All right, let's go ahead and listen to The Alchemist in the City by Stephen Crino.